Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Duarte Geraldino on WNYC. You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. Brian has a day off. Remember what it was like 10 years ago this month when the Great Recession started? Financial markets took a sharp dive. Housing prices were dropping. If it wasn't you, certainly somebody you knew was losing their job. It was tough. People blamed the big banks for getting us in that mess because they were seen as the engineers of a business model that really focused solely on financial profit and not on people.
It's not too late for you!
It's not too late for you!
To take a stand!
Take a stand!
And adopt principles!
And adopt principles!
That allow for all to prosper!
That allow for all!
Now, you were listening to those protesters from that era when they were so angry at the banks. It was that feeling that gave birth to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Now, part of that movement called for more cooperative enterprises where the workers and sometimes even the customers own companies that supply their needs. Our next guest is Nathan Schneider. He says the Great Recession got more and more of us thinking about co-ops as a means of protecting our livelihoods. But cooperatives also come with risks. Nathan Schneider is a professor of media studies at Colorado University. His most recent book is called Everything for Everyone, The Radical Tradition That is Shaping the Next Economy. It was published by Nation Books. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be on the show.
Yeah. So New York City is a city of residential co-ops, but in your book, you actually are writing about worker co-ops so that we have a really clear definition of what these co-ops are. How would you describe them?
Well, actually, I'm looking at this as a much broader tradition that includes both housing co-ops, worker co-ops, and also consumer and other sorts. This is a broad tradition of economic practice in this country that really comes down to businesses that are owned and governed by the people they serve. And that means they're also accountable to the people that they serve. And that's in stark contrast to what we saw 10 years ago when hard decisions had to be made and the big banks and the government, too, ended up opting to back the big investors who own those companies and throw millions of people under the bus. So this tradition that has been that has actually shaped our country in really important ways stands as an alternative that we could turn to if we are really serious about finally righting the wrongs that led to that crisis.
You write about co-ops being an American tradition. How common are co-ops? It seems like in some way we're all connected to one, but we may not actually realize that it's a co-op and not a traditional business. How common are they?
That's right. They're really everywhere. I mean, more than a third of Americans are members of credit unions, for instance. Many people buy cooperative brands like Sunkist or Organic Valley or Land O'Lakes Butter. These are all farmer cooperatives built on decades and decades in the early 20th century of farmer organizing and power building. If you live in a cooperative housing unit, that's another way you might be a co-op member. If you even use a Visa credit card, Visa was originally formed as a cooperative of banks. If your local newspaper is a member of the Associated Press, that is a cooperative of news agencies. So this model is really everywhere. You know, the hardware store down the street can only exist because it's if it's a local store, probably it's a member of a purchasing cooperative that allows it to buy the things it sells at a price that can compete with Home Depot.
How much money are we talking about that goes through co-ops?
It's a little hard to count because we haven't been paying enough attention. Now, finally, we're about to get a good census question about this, but it is certainly trillions of dollars in the U.S. economy. And this is a model that is propping up especially small, accountable businesses all over the place, all over our communities.
Your work is fascinating, Nathan. You write about co-ops as a radical tradition. If they're such a part of the American bedrock, how can they be radical?
Well, they're radical in the sense that this is a forgotten notion at the core, at the root of our of the American idea. You know, when Abraham Lincoln was campaigning for president, he talked about the vision of the individual or the family landholder. You know, when slaves were liberated, you know, they talked about they wanted 40 acres and a mule. This is a tradition of ownership, of people owning and governing the means of production. And since then, we've gone into a model where we just assume we're going to have a job, we're going to rent ourselves rather than being owners of the economy. And in the last few decades, we've seen a process where increasingly wages have gone flat and productivity keeps going up. The money is the value we're creating is going to a small number of owners, and the rest of us who have kind of given up on ownership are missing out.
So the solution then would be for more of us to own the means of production and not lease ourselves out.
Yeah, and really to become artists of ownership, to become creative, you know. And you think about, for instance, the case of some of the big accountability problems we're facing today around online platforms like Amazon and Google and Facebook. You know, all these companies are getting hauled in front of Congress every week, it seems like. And you know, what if these companies, what if through our use, through the personal data that we pour into these platforms, we were becoming owners, these platforms were becoming accountable to us? You know, that's a way of righting some of these accountability dilemmas without just having this kind of strange hodgepodge of international regulation, of ensuring that we can practice democracy as we use these new emerging networks that are increasingly shaping our economy.
But Nathan, I mean, is that likely right now when you look at the venture capitalists? They are trying to invest in a corporation, not necessarily use the services that that company actually provides, and make money. So they want to invest in a small number of owners. Is there a case to be made for venture capitalists to invest in co-ops where the fruits of that investment would be distributed so thinly amongst everyone that it may not make economic sense for them to throw millions at it?
Well, it might not work for the venture capital model as it's constituted today, but that's exactly the point. And in the past, you know, when we've recognized the power of these cooperative models, we've created financing mechanisms to support them. So, for instance, in the 1930s, early 30s, almost all of rural America had no electric power precisely because the investor owners of the big utilities didn't see value in investing in them. So with some government support, with just access to low-interest loans, within about a decade, electric power cooperatives formed across the country and solved that problem with appropriate financing. Now, because of that and other efforts, you know, down the road from me, there's a $128 billion cooperative bank called CoBank. And so I'm part of an effort now known as Platform Cooperativism that is trying to build infrastructure to support a new generation of tech entrepreneurs and communities and workers to have the appropriate financing. So, for instance, we just launched the first equity-based cooperative accelerator called Start.coop. And that's part of the process of building infrastructure. You know, Google actually just gave a $1 million grant to help build this infrastructure as well, especially for people in the gig economy, people who are working at the front lines of this emerging economy. So we're building a new kind of financial and tech infrastructure to overcome the fact that, yes, the way we've been building the tech economy so far is totally oriented toward a model of investor ownership rather than a model of shared ownership and accountability.
If you're listening and you have experiences with these co-ops, whether they be residential worker or service co-ops, give us a ring and let us know what your experience has been. Our number is 212-433-WNYC or 212-433-9692. And later on, we're actually going to learn a little bit more about why New York City is at the forefront of really encouraging worker co-ops to enrich the lives of New Yorkers. Nathan, one of the things that is always striking about the Occupy Wall Street movement is how they were actually pushing for sort of cooperative elements, and then they turned that into political power. What's the link between co-ops and politics?
It's a really interesting question. You know, I got into this project out of my last big book project, which was actually about Occupy Wall Street, a book called Thank You, Anarchy, you know, up close account of some of the leading organizers. And after the protest died down, I kind of followed them as they got into cooperative business, which seemed like the only way to, you know, have a job in an economy that they had not yet transformed, that, you know, accorded with their values. And so here are these, you know, often very leftist, you know, even anarchist radicals getting involved in co-ops. And then in the course of working on getting more and more fascinated with this, I actually, you know, I moved out here to Colorado from New York. This is where my mother's side of the family from. And I started doing some digging and realized actually my grandfather, this, you know, kind of hard conservative farm boy, had been a director of a national cooperative as well. You know, you couldn't imagine anybody more different politically from those Occupy activists, but he was drawn to this model for a lot of the same reasons. And if you look at Congress today, actually the cooperative caucus of senators and Congress representatives is split bipartisan pretty much down the middle. If you look at some of the recent bills that have been passed supporting this kind of model, like the Main Street Employee Ownership Act just a few weeks ago, it is a bipartisan bill. Expanding worker ownership is something that actually both the Democratic and Republican platforms in 2016 supported. So we have a real opportunity in this moment of polarization to get the kind of enabling policy that we need in order to level the playing field, to make it as easy or easier for people to build business with democracy rather than selling their great ideas to the highest bidder.
With these co-ops, there is this romantic idea that if you join a worker co-op, then all of your rights, your worker rights, will be protected. But in your book, I read some examples where co-ops didn't necessarily help everybody, that there was sort of a smaller group of members of the co-op that received disproportionately more benefits. How do you protect yourself in a situation like this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is not an invitation to utopia. This is an invitation to have a better basis upon which to address these challenges and these problems. In the current model, if you have a grievance at work, you know, increasingly people just have no recourse whatsoever. You know, this is a model where at least there is a process. And actually, it points to an opportunity where there are cooperative businesses all around us, from mutual insurance companies like State Farm and Northwestern to our credit unions and much more, where we've kind of neglected the democracy. We've stopped participating. And part of, I think, this opportunity that we have now is to reinvigorate the democracy of the potentially democratic institutions that are already in our midst and make sure that they truly are accountable.
True accountability. Up next, hear about why our area is at the forefront of worker co-ops. The coordinating director of the New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives is going to join us. So join this conversation. Call us at 212-433-WNYC. More up next. I'm Duarte Giraldino. Brian Lehrer is off today. You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. And I'm talking to Nathan Schneider about cooperatives. His recent book is called Everything for Everyone, The Radical Tradition That Is Shaping the Next Economy. Now, we have a new guest here. Sadaf Sayal is also here. She's a coordinating director of New York City's Network of Worker Cooperatives. A lot of people, Sadaf, don't know about this network, but it's pretty well funded now, right?
Yes, that's true. We recently were funded about 5 years ago by the New York City Council. And this was really important because the city became the first local government across the country that decided to support worker cooperatives. You know, in the past in this country, we've seen support for agricultural cooperatives, for example, but this was the first time that the government was supporting the development of worker cooperatives. And that has had a tremendous impact, particularly in the last 5 years, in terms of the growth of worker cooperatives in the city, and the growth of nonprofits being able to provide training, technical assistance, education, and outreach to worker cooperatives, as well as legal and financial supports. But overall, it's a very small amount of money in relationship to the city's overall budget, which is over $80 billion. You know, our
but it's more than most, though. I mean, how much money are we talking about? It's about a million. What?
So in the first year, it was about $1.2 million, and that has gone up over the years. To this year, we've received $3.5 million to support worker cooperative development.
And these worker co-ops, are the members diverse? I mean, which way do they swing? Is it younger? Is it immigrant? What are the demographics?
I think in terms of age, it's very diverse. In terms of race, it's also very diverse. The demographics of the movement has been overwhelmingly led by people of color, by immigrant communities, by women. So it's predominantly those communities that have turned to worker cooperatives as an alternative to the barriers to employment that they face, to the exploitation they are facing in existing workplaces and traditional workplaces. And so we've seen that happen before the economic crisis, I think, in our recent, in the recent kind of stage of worker cooperative growth in this city. Cooperatives began being formed in communities of immigrants and people of color who were turning to it as a model for creating collective ownership of the workplace and for generating jobs.
We have a caller, Sarah from Jersey City, who's been waiting to ask a question about decision making. Sarah, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thank you for taking my call. My experience with co-ops, I think this is a great idea. My experience has been with my daughter who went to a cooperative primary school. When we had to make decisions, we had such discussion, deliberation. It just went on for months and months and months for a decision. I think in most other forums, it would be you have someone that is very, very knowledgeable and they make the decision and it's made. But I must say it took a very long time, but the decisions were very good and most beneficial.
Thank you so
just
much.
Laborious.
Thank you. So Nathan, she raises this question of governance, and I know in your research you found that a very small percentage of people who are actually members of these co-ops turn out to vote. Voter turnout is an issue. How do you deal with that?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it depends on the co-op that you're dealing with. You know, when I was in college, I lived in a housing co-op, and we really needed to meet every month, you know, every week on Sunday night for 2 hours, and it was grueling and difficult and tedious. But you know, otherwise the bathroom wouldn't get cleaned. You know, my credit union is the largest mortgage lender in the region. I'm really glad that they don't call me up every time they need to make a decision about who to lend to. You know, that would be completely unnecessary. They have skilled people to make those calls. I think, you know, often the challenge here is right sizing and appropriateness. And maybe in the case of that school, it would make more sense to empower particular people to make more of those decisions. But actually, you know, maybe the quality of the decisions that the caller referred to was worth that extra time. So it's for the people to decide what the appropriate kind of governance should be for their cooperative. And a lot of the challenges that these things run up against is the lack of experience that people have in making those calls right. But you know, this is, again, an invitation into deepening our skills for democracy so that we know when we can step back and empower others to make decisions on our behalf that are accountable to us, and then, you know, when we can recognize, okay, we need to be part of that.
On the local level, Sadaf, how are you seeing it play out?
Well, there's a lot happening on the local level. I think it's important to note that on the one hand, New York City is home to a very robust cooperative economy that includes food co-ops that are owned by those that shop there, housing co-ops that are owned by those that live there, and now a growing number of worker cooperatives owned by those that work there. And I think that in addition to, you know, the things that have been mentioned, there's credit unions, there's also community gardens and a growing movement for community land trusts as well. So we, you know, work specifically with worker cooperatives, but we're part of this broader, very robust and rich cooperative economy that exists in the city and that's growing. And, you know, that's one really important thing, I think, to note. As worker cooperatives have rolled out and grown in the city, they are now in a variety of different industries.
But so we have... So what are some of the more surprising industries? Because we... Obviously, this is a growing trend, but it's a small portion of the workforce. Some people are drawn to the idea. Others are a little skeptical because of lack of transparency. So aside from housing and food co-ops, which are so popular in the city, what are some of the other ones, and how do you deal with the issue of transparency?
Sure. In terms of worker cooperatives, we have cooperatives in childcare, home care, cleaning, construction, manufacturing, food, catering. It's really a broad range. We have cooperatives for pet sitting, in tech, for bookkeeping. So we've seen them. It's really a model that can work in any industry, and it can work for any community. And so we've seen people in these variety of industries. And it's true, it's hard work, and they're struggling to build models within various industries that can respond to their needs as workers and at the same time compete in the marketplace, right? And so that is a struggle, and you can talk to any worker owner and they will tell you the details of how hard that is on the ground.
We have Elena from Brooklyn who's been waiting to make a comment and ask a question. Elena, welcome to the Brian Lehr Show.
Hi, thank you, Duarte, and hi, Nathan and Seduce. This is such an exciting show. So I actually produce and host another show, a podcast called Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network, and it's a cheese-focused show. And I actually just got back from Berkeley, where I was visiting the Cheese Board Collective, which completely blew me away. For the artisan cheese industry, you know, there's a lot of small businesses, there are succession issues, there's, you know, tiny margins, and I felt like the model that the Cheese Board Collective is operating under solves so many of the problems that I see, especially our local sort of independent specialty food businesses facing here in New York City. So Nathan, I don't know if you focus on them in your book. I'm really excited to read it. And Sadouf, I was wondering, you know, the Cheese Board Collective they have a unique history in that they actually had traditional ownership and the owners sold the business to the employees. And I'm wondering how we can incentivize and educate owners here today in the city to make that switch as part of succession planning, as part of, you know, if they want to alleviate their own sort of responsibility a little bit more.
Thank you so much, Elena. We have limited time left, so if you can answer her questions.
Sure. In terms of conversions, it's a huge opportunity right now. That's really right. And there is support in the city for businesses that are looking to convert. We have we're facing a generation that's retiring, the baby boomer generation right now. And so the idea is if you're a business owner and no one in your family is taking that on, why not offer the business to the workers that have cared for it, that have worked alongside you to build it, instead of it offering it up to the highest bidder who knows what they'll do with it, right? And so there is support for succession planning in the city and support, financial support for workers who want to buy up business.
That is good to know. Nathan, we have about 30 seconds left. Final point?
Well, that's such an important point, this opportunity to transition. And for people who are entrepreneurs who have taken risk to get a return for their risk. So people who are business owners can think about converting to cooperative models. Also, if you're just, you know, looking for a home cleaner, you know, search for Up and Go, a new online platform that allows you to find a cooperative worker-owned home cleaning service in New York City. This is a model that's all around us. It has built some of the best parts of our world, and it can
Thank
help
you.
Shape our future.
Thank you so much, Nathan. Thank you, Sadaf.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Nathan Schneider, Media Studies Professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and Sadaf Sayel talking about cooperatives. Nathan's book is called Everything for Everyone, The Radical Tradition That is Shaping the Next Economy. And Sadaf is the coordinating director at New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives.